and welcome back to the Comic Lyra Podcast, the podcast that does deep dives into the best, worst, and middest of comic books, graphic novels, and sometimes mangas. I'm your host, the soon-to-be-known as Comic Stan, and with me, as always, is my unoccupied adversary of a co-host. It's Jamie.
Yo, what's up?
Did you catch where I got those words? Why I use those words?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Good.
I'm cool with it.
We won't address it any further, then.
An unoccupied adversary.
Yes.
Adversary. Adversary? Yes.
Adversary, yeah, probably.
I'd say adversary.
Yeah, I probably said it wrong. I say words wrong a lot. If you listen to this podcast more than one episode, you know that.
That's kind of the fun of it.
Yeah, it's a bingo card, but you don't know what words I'm about to say. So you have to write down the word. I'm riffing in a way that feels like it's going off a cliff.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, but I caught it very early.
If we had a Jamie bingo card, what would be the top thing on it that I did every week?
Bouts of laughter.
Yeah. Every time Jamie laughs uncontrollably.
Pronouncing super names like surnames, obviously.
Yes. I'm just trying to work out what I bring to this podcast.
Oh, I mean, let's not open that. Let's not open that Pandora's chest if we can avoid it. And speaking of avoiding, Void Rivals is what we are talking about this week. And this is a very interesting one because this is a kind of universe that I don't think either of us are that experienced in before. Because the thing that I didn't tell you about this before reading this, and I don't know if you caught on to this. Do you know what I'm about to say?
Is it that it's a Transformer comic?
Not just a Transformers comic, it's also G.I. Joe.
No, I didn't know that it was G.I. Joe. I clocked that it was Transformers because we saw a Transformer, right?
Yeah, that was a big clue, obviously.
Like, where's the G.I. Joe stuff?
So what's happening is, this is the beginning of the new comic book universe that is combining the G.I. Joe and the Transformers worlds.
And they got Robert Kirkman to do it.
Robert Kirkman, I think, is a big fan of both of those franchises.
They didn't get Robert Kirkman to do it. Robert Kirkman wanted to do it. He was willing.
Yeah, I mean, that's his job now. He just does his dream stuff now.
Yeah, well, I suppose. Yeah, fucking hell. Once you make The Walking Dead, you can kind of do whatever you want, really.
I mean, he became head editor or editor-in-chief or something
of
like
Image,
that
right?
Of Image. Yeah. And that was like his childhood favorite comics, like growing up was Image. Mm. So yeah, he's living his dream. And apparently that involved Transformers and G.I. Joe. Now, In England, we did not get Transformers and G.I. Joe stuff as much. I mean, we've obviously had the Michael Bay films. They were in the past 20 years.
So the Transformers cartoon got syndicated here in the late 80s. But I think that wasn't... But it didn't survive long enough to hit that kind of cycle of Cartoon Network Nickelodeon stuff.
No.
That you and I grew up with. But I definitely remember... Like, my friend who had older brothers, they fucking love Transformer shit.
Yeah.
And so I watched a bunch of the cartoons because my friend was into it because his brothers were into it.
Yeah, and we've all had some of the toys, I think, or at the very least played with, like, knew someone who had some of the toys and played with them as a kid.
Yeah.
Just a thing, a robot transforms into car, transforms back to a robot, like, that's cool. You don't need to know anything
else. The toys are cool as all hell.
Yeah. And the cartoons were essentially... adverts for the toys.
Well, it was that era. It was that era where you could just make a whole cartoon that was a toy advert.
Yeah.
Like, that was really popular back then, wasn't it?
And also, we didn't have G.I. Joe. We had Action Man.
Which is so much better.
I mean, now I'm comparing the two. I think the name is a lot worse. What do we call him? I don't know. Action Man?
Well, yeah. He's a man that does action.
G.I. Joe is a G.I. named Joe. It still feels a little better. Action Man feels like, right, let's put a pin in it for now. Let's placeholder,
yeah.
Action Man, right? We'll put that in there for now. We'll circle back once we've got a better name before we release it. And then they saw it on the shelves like months later, went, oh, bollocks, we never did the name. Oh,
fuck. So I had Action Man as a kid.
I had Action Man as a kid.
Action Man was rad.
I had an Action Man that, and for Americans listening, it's G.I. Joe. Like, it's toys and they...
He's G.I. Joe, but he looks a bit more like James Bond.
Yeah, but in camo stuff.
Well, yeah, but my I didn't have like the Army Man Action Man.
I thought there was only like variations of Army Man Action Man.
Mine was a ninja with a double-ended sword that span when you press the button on his chest.
See, one of mine was a scuba diving Action Man who you could take in the bath with you, and you could wind up a thing or press a thing and his arms would swim. So you could like wind him up and then put him in the bath and he would swim in one direction.
I remember him. And then I had the bad guy as well.
Oh, he's like a goo guy, was it?
Yeah, he was like, he had a purple Mohican, I want to say.
Yeah. Yeah, and I had one that was like a professor. I don't know if he worked for the bad guy. And he was like made of goo and you could like squeeze him and stuff. And he was kind of like a, not flubber, but you know what I mean? Like, what's the goo toy? But like, it was a man, but it was made out of... Like,
Stretch Armstrong.
Yeah, Stretch Armstrong. He was like that, but he was a bad guy.
So, oh my God, this has just unlocked a core memory. So Action Man's adversary was called, do you know what I did there? Was called Dr. X.
Yeah.
How fucking rad he looked. He looked like he could have been wrestling in WWE in the 90s.
He looks like Nick Fury.
I mean...
in a way.
In a, yeah.
Looking at that, so we're looking at a picture right now. I'm assuming it's the first result on Google Images if you search Action Man Nemesis or something.
Yeah.
He looks like they taken Action Men, spray painted them slightly darker, and then use them as the base for the bad guys. Do you know what I mean?
That's absolutely how all action figures work, surely.
Yeah, but what I mean is I think they've taken the exact same ones. Because, you know, like these days, the action figures for nowadays are so, like, detailed.
They're really good.
Like, obviously, previous listener, you know I'm into the wrestling. Wrestling action figures are, like, detailed to be like, look, you've got an action figure release, and you look at, like, and also superhero ones. Like, you see those ones that... People get in boxes and they keep in mint condition.
Yeah.
But some of those are so detailed. You look at them, you're like, they've got the actor from the film.
Yeah.
Like, dead on. Back in our day, it was just literally like, there's one guy, he comes in five skin tones.
Yeah, totally.
The skin tones at that point was like the, oh my God, look how progressive, like, Action Man is now. But yeah, back then it was just one guy.
You can get a Blackshin Man.
Blackshin Man, yep,
that works. I'm so sorry.
If it fits a pun, it's got to work. It's unfortunately, that is the rules.
I hate myself.
I mean, they already used that for blaxploitation films. That was a regular kind of thing.
Yeah, okay. I mean...
Blackshin Man's well under the cultural levels of those. So yeah, Transformers.
Robots in disguise.
G.I. Joe. They're together now. They're doing things now together.
Where does the G.I. Joe stuff come into it?
I don't think it's coming into this. So
right,
okay.
Because I didn't clock it at all.
No, it's not happened yet. Because they're all in space and stuff.
Yeah.
But the point is that this title is the first of the shared universe that they will all occupy.
So has any of the G.I. Joe stuff come out yet?
Yep. They've done some G.I. Joe stuff. There was one that was really popular, which I almost considered us doing.
Yeah.
But then I was like, we don't know G.I. Joe. So then I did this.
At all.
But it was sort of called Duke. So Duke is a character, I assume, who he's got this solo title.
Right.
There's also ads in these for Cobra Commander, who was the evil, the G.I. Joe nemesis.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they're doing that stuff. And I think the point is, the reason they're setting up this shared world is to do stuff where they will cross over and stuff in the future. That's actually come off the back of. So this stuff all started off like mid last year, I think. That's when the news broke. Only recently, like past few weeks, they've announced they're doing crossover films. So this was like almost a year before the announcement that they're doing films.
Sorry, they're doing crossover
Transformer G.I. Joe films.
Why?
Because it's crossover. It's put an X in between two known titles, and it's money.
Isn't it? Well, I know I get that, but it sounds like an atrocious
idea. Alien versus
idea.
Predator,
which is good.
Freddy versus Jason. King Kong versus Godzilla. That one we did recently.
Yeah, but they all kind of make sense. I don't think the Transformers are a natural adversary for G.I. Joe. G.I. Joe is just a dude with a smoothbore rifle.
I don't think they're versus each other. I mean, they might do a bit of punch a bit of, and then
they might do a bit of punching.
Yeah, but they're not going to be proper enemies.
As a side note, by the way, just while we're here and we're talking about G.I. Joe, do you not think the differences between G.I. Joe and Action Man really perfectly articulate the differences between us and the Americans?
I hadn't thought about it that deeply, if I'm being honest.
So G.I. Joe is like the all-American hero, and he's a G.I. and he's in the American army. America, G.I. Joe, blah, 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 blah.
Perfectly encapsulated.
And then Action Man is just, he's a dude. He's a dude who does stuff.
He's a man who does actions.
Yeah, he's a man and he does actions.
He's a man of action. What action that is? Doesn't matter.
No, it's just as long as he's doing something. And it's just like...
Look at his arms. They're moving in a swimming motion.
Because somebody looked at G.I. Joe and went, we could sell those to little English boys. And they looked at it and went, not if you make it really patriotic, you can't.
Yeah, they're going to be like, what's a G.I.? Yeah. That's just too much. Just don't get into it.
Imagine if it was Marine Jack.
Mm.
Or like,
Army Man? Would that be?
Yeah, or like, I don't know.
I bet we are having the exact same conversation that the Hasbro executives were having like... 40 years ago when they were launching this.
Absolutely.
But they had a whiteboard and it was, and again, It was Action Man, and they went, that's a placeholder for now. Don't let it go through. Remind me not to let it go through with that name.
It's like, I mean, because I feel like there are fewer differences between Barbie and Cindy. You didn't grow up with a sister. You probably won't know this. In the UK, we had a competitor to Barbie dolls called Cindy dolls.
Right.
Which were basically, they. I mean, the only way to describe it is they were Barbie dolls, but you could get one with like a bag of chips. I don't know. Like, I wasn't paying much attention.
And someone would come over and go, freshen your tea, governor. Yeah. You know.
It's Barbie, but she's called like Estelle.
A cold crumpet.
That's an alright bit of crumpet, that.
No, like a soggy one, you know.
But no, sorry. I just like, yeah, no, because I remember when I discovered that G.I. It was in adulthood when I started consuming a lot of American media and people started talking about G.I. Joe and I didn't know what it was. And then I saw a G.I. Joe and I was like, oh, that's just a weird looking action man.
Yeah.
That's a very blonde action man.
Like a lot of 80s American stuff, I discovered it through Family Guy. Because Family Guy was, the whole thing was Seth MacFarlane's like, here's stuff from my childhood and now I've got this animated show, so I'm going to just reference everything.
Yeah.
And it was the little jokes. I think the biggest one I remember was the Mexican version of G.I. Joe was G.I. Jose.
Right, okay.
And he was just like, hey, kids, and just spoke in the Mexican accent. And I was like, I assume that's probably funny I knew what the original reference was.
I mean, that's about as funny as Family Guy gets.
Family Guy was good in the beginning. And I stand by it. For what it is, it was its best version in beginning.
Wasn't it really early noughties?
Yeah.
Like 2000? Because really. He stopped. Like, they referenced 9/11 as, after it happened, didn't they?
I remember the first episode premiered in England, along with the first episode of Futurama. And Futurama first episode is the passing of the millennium, so I think that was, 2000, 2001.
So were you watching Family Guy in 2000?
No, not probably. I saw the first episode in... I don't think it stuck very long, because it got, cancelled a bunch in America before it kind of really stuck and was syndicated. But yeah, American stuff, found out through Family Guy, and I was like, what's a G.I. Joe?
Speaking about G.I. Joe in American media, I think my favorite time I've seen G.I. Joe turn up is in the hallucination episode in Community.
Yeah, I did not like that episode.
I really liked that episode. That's a standout for me.
For some reason, I have a bit of an aversion to when episodes of things do a different, not just art style, but a different medium entirely for an entire episode.
But that was Community's thing, the puppet episodes.
But the puppet episodes are still live action. I don't like when when live action goes to animation or animation goes to live action. You know what I mean?
Really?
I'm a bit like, this doesn't feel like, it feels like we're not doing the proper thing. Like, you know me with comics, I'm like, what's canon? What's the main title? Like,
right.
what should I be kind of? So when it goes like that, I think I just get an inherent feeling of this doesn't feel like it's real or part of it. It feels like we're just kind of wasting time. And yet I don't get it from clip shows or, best ofs or whatever.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff.
But I suppose that's what you're going into that experience looking for, isn't it? You go into a best of expecting a best of, right?
Yeah. But even Community did that. They did that really well, where they did the best of where it was none of the previous episodes.
Yes.
It was a clip show, but from episodes we hadn't seen or stories we hadn't seen. But even that felt like, ooh, a cool meta take on it.
Community was so good. I miss Community.
Community was good.
I miss Community.
The film coming out.
I know, 6 seasons in a movie.
Yep.
So I'm really excited to see if they'll get Donald Glover for the Community film.
Apparently he's coming back. Apparently he is.
Sorry.
What he said.
They're not going to... Surely Chevy Chase isn't going to come back for it.
No, he's dead. He might do a cameo.
Oh, is Chevy Chase dead?
I know, he's dead in the show. His character's dead in Community.
Yeah, but come on, this Community.
He'll probably have literally what they did in the first episode of season 6. They'll do Force Ghost... hologram cameo.
I don't know if he'd even come back for it though, because he really fell out with Dan Harmon, didn't he?
Yeah, but I think for money, because what else is he doing? Like, everyone hates him. Like, he's not doing anything else. I think for a bit of money, he'll do a isolated in a booth, not seeing any of the other cast. He'll do like a recorded message kind of cameo like that.
So I think what's really interesting about the Community film, and again, massive tangent, but it's interesting, is that this will be his film debut. For Dan Harmon, this is his first time doing a feature film, isn't it?
He's worked on feature films for sure.
Has he?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I don't know for sure. I'd have to look up. But I bet money,
because I imagine he'll either be the director or the executive producer. Right, he'll be pretty up there in what's happening, won't he?
I don't think he'll direct because he's not a movie director. That will be for someone, and he'll obviously know. He'll know a TV director who would be able to direct.
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, after Community and Rick and Morty, I imagine he could get whichever film director he wanted.
Yeah, realistically. But also the Community film doesn't feel like a big, it's not like Dan Harmon making the switch from TV to film. It feels like a TV movie. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but he's going to have to do something special to do a feature. Like, it needs to be good.
Having Donald Glover in it is probably the biggest.
Well, yeah.
Donald Glover, Joel McHale, who is ostensibly a TV actor, but he's still, like, a name.
I saw him in something with, I saw him in a film about that woman who made a bunch of fake coupons and got arrested for it recently. It's got blonde woman. She was in Forgetting Sarah Marshall. She's a really good actor. I just can't remember her name.
Kirsten Bell.
Yeah, him and Kirsten Bell.
Yeah.
And she, yeah, there's a film about coupons that he's in with Kirsten Bell, and he was really good in that. I remember the massive jump scare for me was when I saw him. This is all going to get cut, man. We're just rambling.
Have we ever cut a ramble before?
This is like OG comic literature, where we spend half an hour talking about other things before we get into the comic.
Should I? I'll put a timestamp so they can skip this part.
It was when I saw Joel McHale do the interview, the roundup interviews at the end of Tiger King. I was like, Joel, what the fuck are you doing here? Like, shouldn't you be making the Community film by now?
I mean, I think he needed a few other people to facilitate that, but
just him.
John McGill's really good at interviewing people where he'll kind of take the piss without them realizing.
Yes.
But not in a mean way, but it's like he'll do a joke that, like, it's more for the audience kind of thing. So, Transformers.
Fucking hell.
We should speak a bit on that before getting to the comic, because there's way more Transformers in this than our G.I. Joe people. Yeah. Transformers, the only thing I want to say, again, we didn't have much of it at all. Transformers the movie is an interesting concept, and this is just a bit of tidbit information I thought was interesting.
Are these the old animated ones or the live action ones?
There was cartoons.
Yeah.
Transformers the movie was the movie combination of the animated cartoon.
Yeah,
basically.
Which I've seen. It's really good.
I've heard a lot of good things. I haven't even seen it myself. What's interesting is they killed off like a bunch of the main characters.
I mean, Optimus Prime dies during the cartoons.
Exactly.
As does Bumblebee. The first Bumblebee dies.
They apparently kill a lot of that characters in a really like surprisingly distressing ways.
Yeah.
In like a surprisingly emotional ways. And the whole reason was it was the capitalism of we want to get the new line of toys out, so kill the old characters and roll out the new ones.
Yeah, totally. But the death of Optimus Prime, I remember that scene. It was really powerful.
And the other interesting point about it is, do you know whose last role they had in the Transformers movie?
What do you mean? Oh, what? So an actor whose last ever role was in the...
Yeah.
No, I don't know this.
Right. So Transformers the movie contains the last acting role before their death 10 months before the release of the final film. So the final film role of Orson Welles.
Holy shit.
Yeah. Who plays a planet-sized, like, evil Transformer.
Fantastic role for Orson Welles.
Yeah.
Like, he has the voice for it, didn't he?
It's a really good role. Like, he's great in it. I think he had no idea what he was doing or what the words on the script even meant, but he gave a great performance. Think of bloody, what's his name in Apocalypse Now, you know?
I mean, a really great example of that kind of thing is... Alec Guinness in as Obi-Wan.
True. I was thinking more of a...
It's not Alec McGuinness, is it?
Alec Guinness, yeah.
Alec
as Obi-Wan, yeah.
Yeah, Alec Guinness as Obi-Wan.
Yeah.
Where he's just like, what is this nonsense? But I'll just say it.
Yeah, I was thinking of bloody The Godfather.
Yes.
Who's the actor?
Al Pacino?
No, the old one. The orange slice in the mouth. You know, that one.
Yeah.
he was a Streetcar Named Desire.
Oh, fuck, yeah, of course. Give us a second.
How can neither of us come up with his name?
Yeah, right.
Marlon Brando.
Marlon Brando.
So, yeah, Marlon Brando in like Apocalypse Now, and he's like, I have no idea what's going on, but I'll just say the words and probably win an Oscar or something. And he turned up, meant to be an army sergeant, and he turned up fat and obese. And the director was like, well, I guess I'll shoot you from the neck up then in darkness. Then it still like was the best movie of all time.
The thing is, once you've got Marlon Brando on board, you get him as he comes.
He couldn't remember his script lines.
Well, he was old.
He had to tape them to... No, he wasn't that old. He was just fat and drugged up and alcoholic. He had to have them taped to his co-star's chest in the blocking scenes.
That's so good.
You know in The Godfather where he's picking up a cat and he's got like a kitten and you come to my day at my daughter's... You know that one.
Yeah.
He's holding a cat and he's got a kitten literally like playing his arms, and I think people took that as like a whole like, oh my god, it's the juxtaposition of he's a violent mob boss, but he's day of his daughter's wedding and he's like holding a small animal and he's, you know, showing his softer side or whatever. Marlon Brando picked that car up off the street. Like he was just like, look at this cat. And he just picked it up and started playing with it. Like, and they were like, we're rolling, Marlon's like, yeah, I'm not putting the cat down. And they were like, fucking, all right, fine. Just roll. Like, let's just go with it.
That's so good.
Yeah.
It's kind of like when Robert Downey Jr. would just get food ordered to him on set.
Yeah, he carried food onto set and they were just like, we can't stop him. He's hidden it everywhere.
Yeah.
And it did add to the character there.
Well, he was just always eating.
Yes.
Yeah. It was great.
All right, so now we are going to talk about the comic.
Transformers.
I am going to 20 minutes, like just after, about 20 minutes.
Oh, mate.
I'm putting it in. So Void Rivals, the culmination, the beginning of a new comic book universe by Robert Kirkman, one of the greatest comic book writers, I think, of his generation. Like,
I mean, he's certainly up there, isn't he?
And just to get all the credits, or at least a couple of them, Lorenzo Delafici, who apparently also worked on Oblivion Song with Kirkman, so they've worked together before, and all new universe. What do you think of this comic book?
Yeah. Good take, Jamie. Well done. That was some really in-depth analysis.
It's one of the comic books of all time.
Yeah, I mean, it exists. So there were certain elements of it, because you told me there was a thing that I was looking for, right?
Just that there was a thing to do with the universe.
Yeah, totally. And so when I saw these two warring aliens, these two aliens from different warring planets, finding out they were more similar than they were different, certainly when they took their helmets off and it turned out they were the same and that they weren't these hideous creatures.
They were inverted colors, essentially.
Yeah, literally. I mean, you know, like one of them could have been the second character skin on a video game for the first one, right?
Yes, 100%.
Like one of them was just player two for the other one.
They were Mario and Luigi.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, when you play Street Fighter and you both want to be Ryu, so one of you has to have a pink gi on. And you're like, oh, I don't want to be pink Ryu.
Imagine a planet full of Marios. And this is like to get across what the plot is for anyone who didn't read it. Imagine a planet full of Marios and a planet full of Luigis, and they... Spoiler for the first issue, I think. They remove their helmets and they look at each other and they both simultaneously go, it's a me.
I mean, that is essentially the plot of the first issue.
Yes.
So when I saw all that go down, I kind of looked at it and went, oh, is this just a copy of Saga?
I had that thought as well.
Yeah.
And I did think to myself, it's different enough that I'm not going to hold it too close to the original.
Gonna be honest with you, not as strong on the opening of Saga. We've not talked about Saga on the podcast, have we?
No, we have not. And by that's some, an ongoing comic.
By some miracle, we've managed not to talk about one of our favorite comics of all time.
So to do Saga, I think we would need to both catch up to it now
and reread the start.
Reread the start, read it up to now. It's been going on for years because it was out when we first were reading comics.
It was out
together.
In the mid-noughties, wasn't it?
We need to read all the way, catch up, and then if we do that, we could talk about the saga that's coming out currently and put it in the end of year roundup. So, and then we could be like, yeah, Saga 1. It's like best comic of all time, like all the
time.
Right,
let's sack this recording off. I know what we need to do.
Start reading Saga.
Yeah. So that kind of element of it, I was like, oh, we're kind of treading on ground that I've already seen.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, the Transformer, like them finding that ship, and sort of charging it up and it just standing up and being like, oh, I've been here for a few million years. I need to go. That really tickled me. And I was like, that's really fun. That's really cool. And it wasn't until I got here and you said, oh, what's the thing?
Yeah.
I was like, oh, is this set in the Transformers universe? I just assumed they'd rip Transformers off.
And so you just thought they put in a robot transforming into a jet as just like a... He's a crazy new character.
Yeah, just like a fun thing. And obviously, you know, everyone would know that it was a Transformer and be like, oh, that's cool.
Imagine a robot that turns into a vehicle of some kind, and we're going to call them...
Shifters.
Robot shifting guys.
I mean,
gals.
And then we can sell them in the UK.
What's the British equivalent of lorry man? Look, he's a lorry and now he's a bloke. Wow.
He's a lot of funny looking geezer him.
Where'd he go? Oh, he's a lorry.
I was just in the old posh shop getting some jelly deals. You would believe what I saw, mate. You wouldn't have had him in either.
All right, so back to the comic.
I mean, I thought, like, if you want actually just like a very general overview of what I thought of it, I felt that the plot skipped along quite quickly.
Yeah.
Which I'm okay with because it's an adventure comic. at its core, it felt like an adventure comic to me.
Yeah.
And so I'm okay with the plot skipping along quite quickly. There was an ever-rotating cast of characters for our protagonist to kind of deal with. There was some intrigue. It wasn't anything special in terms of story for me.
Yeah.
It wasn't particularly breaking any new ground, but it was doing what it was doing relatively well, and it was paced fast enough that I could just skip through it.
Yeah. I felt like this... I have to kind of give this the kind of overall summary of mid, I think.
Oh, totally,
which is
yeah.
shocking considering who it's written by. I feel like this is a bit of a churn it out. I think Kirkman kind of churned this out like in relatively quick time. I think his skill set, he can just be like, here's a story. Here's a competent story.
Yeah.
I think he could just do that. I was expecting a lot more, and I think that has a, you know, we've said before, like, your expectations going into something is affects your
absolutely.
Your opinion of it at the end.
Yeah.
I was expecting Invincible, Walking Dead, and then as I was kind of starting this, I was like, okay, it's a kind of by the numbers tropey space opera kind of story.
Yeah.
But he's, you know, he's had that before. He had superheroes and he did, you know, made something amazing out of that. Very tropey superhero thing. To the point where Invincible is so tropey. It's like, here's a Superman character.
Yeah.
Here's a Gambit character. Here's a, you know, robot character.
Here's all of the Justice League.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, totally.
Walking Dead, just the zombie trope. Mm. It was like, what do you do with that? He almost was not allowed to make The Walking Dead for Image Comics. Because Image Comics were like, what's the interesting thing about this? Like,
yeah.
It's zombies, but we've got that already. We've like that's been done a bunch already. Like, what's the hook? And he lied and said, oh, it's going to be revealed that it's aliens. And I'm going to reveal that in like issue 7 or 10 or something.
And just never did it.
And no, he even said, and there's going to be clues in the first few issues, like leading up, they'll reveal it. And they were like, okay, never happened. Like, there were never any clues or anything. So even then, he knows that like he could take a trope-heavy, worn genre.
Yeah.
And for this, I think he just did the tropey genre. I don't think he did anything new or interesting in it.
Which ultimately, there's nothing wrong with that.
I mean, if you are just, again, if you're just churning out a story and getting a paycheck, like, good on you.
Well, I mean, there's a place for tropey, pulpy stories. And that place is comic books.
Yeah.
This story is perfectly suited to the medium, is what I would say for it.
Mm.
It's a story that could only be told in a comic book, and it's very well, it's competently done, and it looks pretty, and the dialogue is good, the dialogue's okay, there's nothing that screamed out at me, there was nothing that I ever read and went, ugh. You know, the dialogue was perfectly serviceable, the story was perfectly serviceable, it's just not as well developed as I think we've come to expect from Robert Kirkman, but potentially, we're only 8 issues in, and this is them setting up a whole universe, right?
Yeah.
And we had the same, I think we had a similar conversation right at the start of the podcast about...
Why the Last Man?
No, the superhero one.
Oh, Invincible.
No.
Rogue Son.
Yeah, we had a similar conversation about Rogue Son, didn't we?
Yes.
Which is that this is, I mean, you I think you liked Rogue Son more than I did. I think if I revisited Rogue Son now, I'd probably like it more. Because I'm a bit more knowledgeable about comic book tropes after 2 years of making this.
Yeah, I felt Rogue Son did some more interesting stuff.
But ultimately, on some level, like maybe he had to play it a bit safe because this is them launching this is him bootstrapping a wider universe. And if he really stretched himself creatively and this was a flop, then that completely jeopardizes what they're trying to achieve here.
Yeah.
And so there is potential here that this is the establishing shot at the start of a movie. This is that sweeping pan over the desert with Arabic music playing in the background that tells us we're in the desert, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean. And you got to remember, like, I'm interpreting what you're saying is you have to remember that with comics generally, like, the first act can be, like, the first half a year of release, like, 6 issues. First volume, essentially.
Mm.
Kirkman especially, like, big thing with Invincible was the moment that Invincible went from tropey superhero story to something different was, like, issue 7 or 8. I'm trying to remember whichever one I told you to read up to, and I was like, get to this issue because that's when the things happen. That was like almost a year.
And then The Walking Dead really didn't get going, I think, until we meet all the other characters and it turns out that, or at least for me, until, what's the protagonist's name?
Rick.
Rick, until Rick finds out that his wife had been sleeping with his best friend.
Yes.
That's when The Walking Dead really warmed up to me, and I was like, wow, there's, you know, what we're actually seeing is these family structures break down and new family structures form, and we're getting a really good look at what Robert Kirkman thinks our human response would be to this thing, right? And so it took a little while for him to really reach those heady heights. And for me, like, the most powerful stuff in The Walking Dead wasn't until hundreds of issues in when we see Carl start to hit adolescence.
For me, it was a bit before when he was killing off likable, valued characters.
That,
like,
was powerful stuff.
Made you really feel no one was safe.
But that was plot heavy.
Yeah.
That was plot stuff. But for me, like, The Walking Dead became at its most powerful, as I say, when Carl starts to hit adolescence, and we start to see tragedy, this level of tragedy through the eyes of somebody who was too naive to remember the world before it.
Yeah.
And that's when it became for me like, fuck, I'm reading something really special here. And, you know, watching Carl latch onto Negan as a role model because Negan was so perfectly suited to this world. And, you know, that stuff was really fascinating. And so I am really inclined to give Robert Kirkman some time with stuff that he writes, because I've found that with the stuff of his that I've really liked, the bits of it that have been the most compelling to me have come to way later than this.
Yeah. And that would be my one, I think, saving grace for why I would consider continuing this past what we've read.
Yeah, totally.
But even then, I feel like if I got to, like, I don't know, 20 issues and I hadn't had an inkling of something like that yet, I'd be a bit miffed, I think.
So sometimes we read things for this podcast and I think, wow, I could quite happily go back and next week and read the next issue and read it weekly.
Yeah.
With this, I would happily read more, but I'm probably going to wait 6 months.
Yeah, 6 months to a year.
Until there's another volume out, and then binge another volume of it. Yeah. I could gladly spend another hour and a half, 2 hours with it over an evening, sat on the sofa with my cat. I don't know that I'll be waiting for it every week.
Yeah, that's fair. And one thing I should have mentioned up top as well, which I thought was interesting, one of the reasons why I thought to do this at all as well,
yeah,
when I've been banging on about Ultimate Spider-Man that's just come out, or yes, it's coming out right now. We will be doing it once it hits kind of 5 or 6 issues. It's so good. The first issue I read is so good.
Please reach out and save me from this hell.
Yeah, but you love Spider-Man comics.
No, I don't.
No, so you love them when they're good. I'm telling you that. That's a thing you'll find. So with that,
yeah, because I don't think I've liked a single Spider-Man comic that we've read.
To be fair, we've gone out of our way to read the worst, except for that first one I did recommend.
We haven't I haven't really given Spider-Man a fair shake of it, have I?
No, we've gone our way, and maybe that will affect your, you know, next experience of Spider-Man.
Yeah,
but so main point is, I went to the local comic book store to see. I thought they're probably not going to have any, but I'll see if they have any Ultimate Spider-Man's like physical copies, because I wouldn't mind having one. And I asked them, they said, yeah, obviously not. We're waiting for like a second reprint. I was like, fair enough. Like, maybe I'll come back in and check again later or whatever. And I said, oh, so this one's done pretty well. Like, I was just kind of interested. Like, what's the level of comic book sales generally, like, in relation to this? And they went, we haven't seen something go this quickly for a long while beforehand, except for Void Rivals. Void Rivals was the big seller all of a sudden. Like, we have never seen this before until Ultimate Spider-Man
really
kind of knocked off.
So yeah, this is hugely popular then?
I think the concept was hugely popular. I don't know what the sales have been like since then.
Yeah.
But I think when the idea of not only, you know, big announcing Transformers, G.I. Joe, big universe starting at Image, like, that's one thing. And then Robert Kirkman is writing the first series. You're like, oh my God.
Yeah, I mean, that's an easy sell, isn't it? But this won't even have had enough issues to be in trade paperback yet, right?
I think this has, yeah. Like, normally 5 to 6 is normally a
volume. Right, okay. So we've seen a volume.
It normally takes a bit for that to come out.
Yeah, so this has just had enough for its first trade paperback.
Yeah, I reckon so, yeah.
Okay. Which isn't a lot in retrospect. You know, relatively speaking, that's not a lot of content, is it?
No, but I think for most comics, it should be enough to, like, give you an idea of what it is.
Yeah.
Like, if we're talking about, like, TV shows, I think, like, a volume is enough for, like, an episode of a TV show. If you're kind of comparing, like, mediums and amounts, I think if you can, there's loads of TV shows you can say, oh, it takes a few episodes to get in.
Yeah.
But I also, and I've recommended those shows to people.
Yeah.
But I also feel like the job of a TV show, that's a fault of it if it doesn't hook you immediately.
Yes,
because it's one job. It's like, look what we're showing you, look how awesome it is, come back next week.
It's there solely to get your attention, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's great shows I'll recommend to people. I'll go, it takes a few episodes to get in, like, but the whole, like, Community. Like, the first series of Community is nothing like the season 2 and 3, are they?
Still good.
It's still good, but, like, Parks and Recreations is a great example. First season of that is not very good.
Do you know what? I never made it through Parks and Rec because the first season was so slow.
Exactly. Yeah. Literally, start season 2. You don't even need the previous series story. Just start season 2 and it gets way better from there. Mm. But the point is, I can still argue you should watch these things, but I can still admit that that's a fault of theirs, that they didn't get good by
a certain time. I see your point. I see where you're coming from.
I think comics should be good from the start, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, you want to run at a fair clip and keep go steady, right?
Yes. And we've seen, because we've read so many that were great from the start as well. So,
yes.
Dying with the Arting, it's nowhere near the start. It's nowhere near the start, and it's barely anything to say about the Arting. I was just going to say I like the line work and I like the style. I like the rough line work and the additional lines and stuff like that.
So I didn't think much of it compositionally in terms of the actual composition of the panels, because there was all, and I'm going to pull up issue 1 and just show you some stuff and see what you think of it. Do you know what? I was listening to a podcast today. I was listening to an old episode of Hello Internet, because I still do that sometimes because I love Hello Internet. And Brady was showing Gray Flags, and it was the most boring thing in the world. And now I'm just doing it. So
do you want me to cut out some parts? Do you want to take a minute, which I will cut out, and it will seamlessly be, it will seem like we're professionals who have everything ready to go before we actually talk about it.
So compositionally speaking, there was just some things that I felt were a little bit weak. So
right.
Panels like this, where they're zooming out to show us something, I feel are a little bit muddy and just could have been put together a little bit better.
Yeah.
There are also some panels which were compositionally really beautiful and really well put together. So, for instance, I felt that the composition here was really very good, and I got a really good sense of space. I got a really good sense of where they were. I got a really good sense of what was happening. So I think, there's some fantastic composition here mixed in with some composition that isn't quite as good. I mean, this panel, for instance, you know, in terms of like a vista and a space scene, I think that's really beautiful and really well drawn.
Yeah. I was going to credit the color composition, color choice, especially. Space is very,
You can see what they're doing here, right?
In what?
In the color.
I was going to point out the pastel colors used for space. So, obviously, the colors in the respective alien species is like, look at these guys in the red and these guys in the green.
Yeah, but they're doing a thing that is really common in film, really common in the Michael Bay Transformers films as well. It's all blue and orange. So blue and orange are contrasting colors on the color wheel.
Right.
So if you really want something to pop, you saturate it all so everything's blue and orange.
Maybe like fire and water kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, blue and orange are just, they're contrasting colors on the color wheel.
Right.
And so if you really want something to pop, put blue, loads of blue next to loads of orange, and you get something really poppy.
Mm.
If you go back and watch the Michael Bay Transformers films, they're all blue and orange, right?
Right.
And that's a color language thing, and that's a compositional thing. They're using a lot in that first issue, particularly.
Yeah.
Because they're on that very bluey island, that very bluey planet, sorry, with a blue backdrop for space, and then one of the character models is orange, and one of their spaceships is orange. They're using a lot of blue and orange there. And that contrast in itself is enough to carry the art through for a lot of it.
Yeah. I was just going to point out the uses of colors were like boring colors versus more exciting times. Like,
yeah.
There's darker, more single color for not, like whenever they in memories to their species and like flashbacks, that kind of stuff. Very much getting across the, look at all this, it's all uniform and it's all the same. It's like, but when they're in this new area with these two opposite, you know, people from opposite civilizations, like, ooh, we've got like fire and bright contrast and it's exciting now.
And they did something where they showed you them, both of them setting off, and one half of the panel was him and one half of the panel was her.
Yeah.
And it was their respective races, and they used two really distinct color palettes, right? So yeah, there is quite a good use of color here, actually.
There was some good panel layout with the combining with the narration. So they're talking about the respective country, the respective species, and they're literally two panels that like, they're exactly the same, but they're the different species. And the narration in the middle is talking about their differences and how different they are and how they could never reconcile their differences.
I suppose my argument here would be that because of who's made it, the bread and butter stuff has all been done very well.
Yes.
Like, the art looks good. The dialogue looks good. The plot itself is good. There's just not enough of the plot for me.
I think the main thing for me is I just didn't care about the characters enough to be invested in the plot.
Yeah, sorry. There's enough plot, but there's not enough depth to really make any of it matter.
Yeah. There's certain things, especially Kirkman, is like, he's so good at getting across, like, look at this person and the odds they're facing.
Yeah.
And I think he's definitely attempted it. I think it's just a bit of a swing and a miss. Because we've got this, like, these two characters who are sworn enemies most of the time, they got a bloody work to. And you know what? I like that. I really like that. But you get through it very quickly. So, like, what, two issues?
Yeah.
And they're kind of ready to go. And it's then, oh, now we've got to deal with, now that we're going on a bit of a space adventure. It's like, okay, we're doing something a bit different here. There's a lot happens, but not enough to actually make me fans of the characters.
I suppose that reconciliation happens a bit too quickly for me as well, because they're fighting for about four panels.
Yeah.
And then one of them has the opportunity to take the kill shot, basically. Doesn't, despite the fact that his robot communicator thing is telling him to. And then they lay it on really thick about, oh, well, aren't you sworn to this? And aren't you not allowed to do this? And they really introduce some really heavy lore from both of their races. And it felt really expositional.
Yes, 100%, yeah. 100%.
And again, you know, it would have been more interesting or more compelling for me if some of that stuff was left unsaid. And so we see them, you know, kind of going through this interaction. Because to be honest with you, if you're from one race and you have an enemy who's from another sworn race.
In alien terms, we should say.
Yeah.
Alien terms.
Yeah, absolutely. And your entire lives, you've been fed this, you know, heavy, almost theocracy about each other and your roles and what's sacrosanct and what you are and aren't allowed to do. When you met and spoke with somebody from the other race, you wouldn't feel the need to quote all that stuff because you'd just assume that you both knew it.
It's like in films and TV where they go, hey, bro, hey, sis.
Yeah,
like that.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's overly expositional, which is fine. Like, we've talked about this, and I think exposition can be a really useful shortcut to get your audience to where you need them to be to understand what's coming next.
Hmm.
It's just there wasn't a whole lot of what was coming next.
Well, I think
he had plenty of page space to feed us that information in a more compelling way, right?
Yeah. All that came next was more exposition and more plot and more, like, it just, stuff kept happening. And I was, there was never a point to kind of, there was no points to build any kind of emotional thing.
Mm.
And you look at things like, again, like, we're going to keep comparing them because they are his best stuff. Invincible had those moments of Mark, the young superhero, discovering his powers and being like, you know, it's a puberty allegory. And and he's like, accidentally throws a trash bag and it's like goes into, and he's like, whoa, and he's like, you see the marvel on his face.
Yeah.
And you go like, I like this guy, like, he's probably going through something difficult, and I'm liking seeing him going through this, and he's got a dad that's got all the stuff that to help him, like, you know, it takes the time to develop that stuff. And then when the big stuff happens, you go, oh, not Mark, like, please no. Walking Dead, there's a long period of time, I say long, like a couple of issues, where Rick's by himself and he's trying to find other people, and he's trying to, you know, there's the whole first issue, if I remember correctly, is him waking up from the coma, getting out of Atlanta or wherever he wakes up, and he's getting to Atlanta or wherever, takes the time to be like, look at this difficult scenario this character is in. Here we have got these two characters in a difficult scenario. But the biggest threat to them should be each other. And that's resolved really quickly.
Yeah, exactly.
One of them literally just goes, hey, we need to work together to survive. The other goes, well, I don't bloody like you, but I guess I'll bloody do it. Like, it's kind of like, they should kind of be fearing each other as the worst. Like, they should feel each other as the biggest threat on this planet, comet, rock, whatever they're on.
Mm.
And as you say, they very quickly just resolve it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I definitely have helped. You've helped me articulate that kind of feeling that I had.
Yes.
I will say there's a lot of little things that I liked. And I think that, as you say, that is that Kirkman, like, he can't help but put in little interesting concepts and stuff.
Yeah, totally.
But the big overall picture was not enough to really draw me in. I liked Handroid.
Yeah, Handroid was fun.
Handroid, the name Handroid is great. Great pun. You know, I was saying last week, we were talking about She-Hulk, and there's a concept there, Punch Club, and I was like, I hate that name. It did not take very long to name that group.
Yeah.
It feels lazy. Handroid feels like the one where it's very quick to name, but you quickly come out with, what about Handroid? And you go, oh my God, that's the best name ever.
Like, has nobody thought of this before?
Yeah, like Google it. Has that ever happened before? And you're saying about how long they take. He devotes like a page to the hand crawling, dragging the character out. I thought, I immediately thought, oh, we're onto a winner here.
Yeah.
He's taking the time. He's doing the details. He's building the stuff up. The hand drags him out of the crashed spaceship, locates the first aid kit.
Yeah.
Drags him all the way, like one hand, like, and he's got a bit of the arm as well, dragging this lifeless character all the way across the floor to this thing, presses the button, and the first aid kit launches out, and it's now further away again, and the hand's like, oh man. and again, extra panels, turns around, drags him away. And I thought, I was reading that, I thought, oh, we're in it, Kirkman classic, let's go. And it never got as good after that.
And again, you know, we're in an issue like 3 or 4 and the plot's really skipped along, but I don't necessarily care about anything that's happening.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's the thing. And I suppose it would, like, often we like to talk about plot and we like to talk about story, but I think here it's almost tangential to the discussion about this comic book because so little of it is actually of interest.
Yeah.
I don't even particularly want to talk to you about the plot and what's happening here because not a lot is happening. Everything is happening, just none of it seems to matter.
I think the problem is Kirkman is writing this kind of genre without realizing that all the stuff he's doing has been troped like heavily and referenced and stuff.
I don't know that though, because he is a comic book obsessive.
Yeah, but not, I don't mean in comic books specifically. Like,
So
one thing I noticed while reading this, I found myself, and I think this is an example of, I'll ask you a question after this. I think this is an example of me not being as excited about the plot. I was picking out where I knew tropes from.
Yes.
In this. Each issue seemed to have 2 or 3 tropes on. I know that from another thing.
Yeah.
And it has Kirkman just kind of gone, is this his version of churning out stuff? Probably unconsciously, is he just like, yeah, I'll nick this from this and I'll get this from this and this would be cool if this happened. And he's unconsciously just picked things out from stuff he's watched or consumed.
Yeah.
And my question to
which
you
is how influence works.
Exactly. And that's
cool.
My question is that fair to criticize something for that?
Because it's not
ripping off one thing. But I found myself being like, these are very specific. Within the space genre, the sci-fi space opera,
I know where you're coming from.
And I've got like lists of things that I picked out. I was like, well, that's from that. So firstly, there's a witch coven that with political influence that's part of one of the races. And I was like, that's Dune. There's a... How far did you get all 8 issues?
Yeah.
So there's the Proximus character.
Mm.
Whole tropey character. Because they've got the leader of one of the races like, well, we need to make sure that they don't reach their goal or that they, you know, we need to make sure they get killed.
Mm.
I'm going to enlist Proximus. And the very tropey, like, people under me like, sir, you can't release Proximus. You must be. And I'm just reading it just like, this is a thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is the thing of like the bad guy in a film being like Pirates of the Caribbean. I'm going to have to unleash the Kraken. So not the Kraken. Like, you'd be mad to do that to build the, you know, the threat of the protagonist. Hiring someone to chase the protagonist was a trope that I had to rack my brain thinking, is there a better example
than Boba Fett?
No, than the SpongeBob movie where a character literally hires the badass motorcycle riding to hunt and stop the main character, SpongeBob and Patrick. I was like, it's a trope because SpongeBob are doing this trope, like that's the joke, they're doing this trope from other films, and I could not think of like Boba Fett is probably one of the closer ones, but I couldn't think of like surely there's a better example of this trope. The character himself is great reveal in this part, by the way. The conversation he's having with the main bad guy, the king of the whatever characters, there's a lot of alien, there's a lot of Rick and Morty like games, the Zergs and the Ergs and the Zergs and the Schlorpians and all that. But he's speaking with him and it's a weird red room and the guy's being like, yeah, why should I help you? And he's like, come on, mate. And he's like, all right. Also, you're fearing so-and-so might rise, you know, the breadcrumbs of the bad thing that'll happen later on. And then the close-up panel, splash panel is a strong word for this, but it's a one-page close-up panel of the character's face. He's like, yeah, all right, I'll help you. And the next page is him in the liquid chamber kind of thing. And I was like, that's cool. Like, I didn't see that coming. If you surprise me, at this point in this comic, if you surprise me, great. Like, well done.
So going back to the question you asked.
Also, that was Darth Vader.
Yes, yeah, of course.
I was just playing that game. I was like, that's from that, that's from that.
Going back to the question you asked me.
Yes, is it fair?
Well, I think it becomes about a wider question about influence. And so on one level, it's impossible in this day and age to make something that isn't biting from a million different things.
Mm.
We live in a time that is so heavily saturated with story, and also stories that are preserved. And I think this is the salient point here, is that I was reading about this the other day. There are loads and loads of music. There are loads and loads of really popular songs from the last 100 years that we don't have recordings of, right?
Mm.
Because they were recorded, but they were recorded onto old style radiogram records that have disintegrated now, and there were no big recordings, and they haven't made it onto the internet. And so the only way they exist is in songbooks, right?
Right.
Like, if you can get an old songbook from the 20s, you can learn, it will have sheet music for these songs, you can learn them and play them, kind of. Whereas now we live in an age where everything that's been made in the past 50 years is pretty much preserved.
Yes.
And so we have access to a greater library of media now than any human being has ever had before. In our generation, with access to the internet, we can access everything. And it means it's really easy for us to track influence. And so it's really, really difficult to make anything that isn't influenced by something or doesn't show its influences. But back in the day, that didn't matter, because everybody kind of forgot everything a generation at a time. You weren't necessarily hunting through your parents' old stack of books to look for the stories that they were reading. You were just buying paperbacks of stuff that was being written now, right? Whereas now you can find an archival record of everything that's ever been made. And so it's almost harder to avoid ripping from stuff now. Mm. Also, it's so much easier to trace that influence in the way that you just did.
Yeah.
Like, you're super familiar with media from the past 50 years because there's a record of it. I don't know if this is necessarily about people becoming less creative in their stories, because I don't think we've ever been that creative in the way we tell stories. We're always synthesizing influence. One of the most beautiful things about being human, right?
Yeah. I think here's my major problem. I think it's to kind of get across the feeling and the reason why and everything. I think the problem here is there's not much else, and everything is stealing everything, right?
Yeah.
There's nothing new under the sun. Everything is an influence of everything. It's all a cultural blender that you take all the stuff that you've seen and then you put it in the blender, you make something new, and it's a
blend.
Patchwork of, yes.
As a YouTube deep cut.
And I think my problem with this is that none of the stuff it takes are different enough or blended enough. It's like, it's, you know, you put, like, again, you put stuff in the blender and you make a new story out of the tropes, you know, right?
But you only pulse it a few times.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you just go, and then it's like, right there. It's like, you can still see the ingredients. You can still see the raw ingredients.
There's chunks of parsley in my story.
If the writing process, and by writing, I mean the vaguest, the basic concept of, like, creating story, right? If the writing process is taking your influences, mix them together, and making something new, I think this is like a very, like, a quick press on the blender of writing, and he's gone, right, there we go.
Yes.
And I think that's the problem I have with it, is there's good stuff in it, there's inventive stuff in it, there's the hand droid, and there's the way some of the conversations play out, there's the interaction on the ship they first get onto, where they very quickly not even negotiate their way out. The guy's just like, whoa, hang on, like, it turns out there's been a bit of confusion, let's do a deal. And the prisoner they release, you just automatically assume that prisoner is going to be like, he got me as well, like, but we can work together, we'll get off and I'll join you on your adventure.
Yeah.
And the guy's like, no, that guy's a real piece of shit, like, that guy's a real criminal, like, he's a bounty, like, oh, a bounty on him.
Yeah, I mean, so, there are interesting things in it, aren't there? No, I'm with you there, and I hadn't really thought of it on that level.
I think everything borrows from stuff, but you need to make something new, and there's a certain level of quality, and you need to mix them up enough to make it seem like a new thing. Blend it. I think that is the greatest term for it. It's like, blend it enough you can't see the original, the raw ingredients.
And then you just have your own delicious but homogenous sludge,
yes.
Right?
And but then even that, people will, they might taste it and might be like, oh, there's hints of bloody, you know,
parsley in there,
Darth Vader's character thing, you know, there's hints of that. Like, bloody Invincible is a treasure trove of superhero tropes.
Yes.
Like, that is literally, but you're enjoying the main thing, the main story so much that you don't care.
And I suppose I mean, the two comic books that we keep going back to, two Robert Kirkman titles, are Invincible and The Walking Dead.
Yes.
And the one thing that they share is are these really intrinsic human stories. Ultimately, we're both saying, wow, that Robert Kirkman writes these fantastic human stories. And then we've looked at this and gone, well, this doesn't really have that much humanity in it. Yeah. There's nothing to latch onto. And the way the characters relate to each other is all very surface level.
Yes.
And that makes it feel low stakes to me. That's the problem. Yeah. It feels really low stakes because I'm not super invested in anything that's happening because I'm not invested in the characters. And that isn't to say I need to like the characters, but I can be passionately invested in detesting a character.
Mm. I can hate a character, but still want to see more of them.
Yeah, like, absolutely. You know, that's the way I feel watching all sorts of things that I love.
Mm. I felt this to me was kind of reminded me of, I've kind of got two kind of ways to describe how I'm feeling about this, right? It kind of feels like, and there's some good stuff in there. I keep hammering that.
Keep reiterating.
I don't want to shit on it. I don't want to shit on it completely to be like, it's bad, because it's not bad. It's fine. It's okay. It reminds me of either a Rick and Morty ad thing or a Saturday Night Live parody of a concept or a genre.
Yes.
Right?
If
you distill what the story is, it feels like the last 10 years of like honed sci-fi stories. It's like two aliens from warring planets who find out they're not so different from each other, but there's also a secret like conspiracy between their planets that's trying to stop the truth getting out, and they've got to work together to like, it feels like that, you know.
So you're saying it's so tropey that it starts to feel like pastiche.
It's not just tropey in the story like I've just done, but also it's tropey in the specific tropes it uses, the specific sci-fi tropes. Another one, the ring planet is from Halo.
Yeah,
like that's a very Halo thing. Just caught like loads of little things.
And
like
I suppose
that.
Sci-fi these days, at least, is a very tropey genre.
The badass character rides a space motorbike.
Yeah. Like no, I get it. Like if you once you start digging, and scratching under the surface.
The character's bow thing, that reminds me of the Omega beams from DC that Darkseid uses. So they're beams to shoot out of his eyes. He shoots them from a bow. But once they go, they're guaranteed to hit the target.
Like a red shell.
Yes. So, literally. But with this, if you miss, if you dodge it somehow, it then turns around and comes back.
Yeah.
So the whole point is like, it will get you no matter what.
Yeah.
Again, just a little thing. I was like, that's from that. And I feel like this is like this feels like Kirkman's patchwork version of a sci-fi opera story.
Do you think he's going for pastiche?
It's hard to say, because in Invincible, and again, we keep coming back to these, Invincible was very on the nose pastiche, because I feel like with him, he already felt there's nothing new under the sun with superheroes. So rather than wasting time trying to be creative and make new powers and new heroes, let's just parody them. Let's just pastiche them.
Gave him loads of space to do loads of interesting other stuff. That's the thing. It gave him loads of space to be interesting in other places. Whereas, it's hard. The idea of, I wouldn't write a sci-fi. This is the thing. I wouldn't write sci-fi because it's such a well-worn genre now.
Mm.
And you look at the way it's evolved through Isaac Asimov.
Will Smith.
through people like, what's her name?
Modern?
Ursula Le Guin.
Okay.
Ursula Le Guin is a great sci-fi writer.
Right.
You know, from kind of Isaac Asimov through Ursula Le Guin, and then through kind of Star Trek, Star Wars.
Dune. Frank Herbert.
It's evolved and it's morphed and it's become more and more homogenous. If you look at early sci-fi, it was way different.
Mm.
Like early sci-fi was all very distinct, because
this is why I distinguish with sci-fi opera, because this feels like Dune, Star Wars specifically.
Yeah, Dune and Star Wars specifically, and then I suppose Star Trek came at the same time or before.
Like 70s, like Star Trek was really early.
Yeah, so Star Trek's older than Star Wars, isn't it?
I think, yeah, not by much.
But I suppose, yeah, the idea of a space opera is very Star Wars-y. Star Wars-ian?
Yeah,
Star Wars-y?
Sure. Yeah.
I don't think there's a term for it. I don't think anybody's verbed it.
But it should be now, because it's just because it literally is so culturally impacted. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so prevalent. And again, I suppose this comic book came at a time where we have a glut of that as well, because Disney have gotten hold of Star Wars and they're making a ton of Star Wars stuff.
Yes, they are, yeah.
And so this has come at a really interesting time where actually, if you want a space opera story, you can just grab some Star Wars. Like, there's always some Star Wars going about.
Yeah, there's always some form of Star Wars, whether it's your core original brand Star Wars or it's off-brand something else Star Wars.
Well, I mean, at any given time, there is something Star Wars branded coming out at the moment.
Yeah, but I mean, it's because it's how influential it is. There's so much other stuff that's like Star Wars. There's obviously Pepsi to Coke, but then you've also got your off brands like Cola brand or like Dr. Pepper's all his ones. Dr. Pepper's great, but what I mean is like the other doctors. So there's literally like other Dr. Pibb and Dr. Pop and, you know, cheap brand Dr. Pepper.
I really like the idea that if they ever do like a premium Dr. Pepper, they should make it Mr. Pepper.
Nah, doctors. Because doctor feels like the premium, doesn't it?
Yeah, but once they become a consultant, they stop being doctor and they start being Mr. again.
Right. But they retain their PhD, don't they?
They retain their PhD, but a consultant doesn't like to be called doctor. They're Mr. or Mrs. because they've gone past being a doctor. And so, yeah, like Mr. Pepper is like the consultant version of Dr. Pepper.
I feel like it's not a great idea when you have to explain why it's technically correct.
Yeah, I suppose.
Like,
and that might only be a thing in the UK. That may well only be a thing in the UK. It might be like our American listeners are like, what the fuck is that guy on about?
I feel like if I picked up a Mr. Pepper, I would feel like it's the cheaper brand.
What about a Mrs. Pepper?
Well, that could also be Dr. Pepper, though.
Yeah, no, it could be. Well, yeah, but so could Mr. Pepper.
Yeah, but that's what I mean is Mr. and Mrs. are both. Both feel like the cheaper version of Dr. Pepper, which is the premium of
I think that's misogynistic.
It's actually Dr. Pepper is, you can tell it's Mrs. Pepper when it's Dr. Pepper because it costs less. Is that work? I'm trying to
cut this whole bit out.
No, I'm keeping it in. I'm trying to get a gender wage gap.
You're trying to get a wage gap joke? Yeah. A wage gap joke?
Yes.
Wage joke gap? I don't know.
Do you want me to retake that part?
Nah, it's fine. Right. You're leaving your bit in, I'll leave my bit in.
Yeah, but the main point is I'm trying to show how woke we are. So,
yeah, absolutely. Anyway, so fucking woke.
So, yeah, not much else to say on it, really.
No!
It was an interesting one to discuss because there's stuff around it. I have had this thought before of, I think we've said before, it's great when a comic is either great or terrible. Like, those are the interesting ones to discuss.
Exactly.
Mid comics that are normally not as interesting to discuss, but I feel like this was such an interesting one for me because I had this specific thing of, why does it feel like a grand thing and it's not? And
you had really high expectations going in.
Oh, yeah.
And again, I mean, it's from arguably one of the best comic book writers of his generation. It's from somebody who's made some really special stuff.
Yeah, like some of the greatest comics of all time.
Yeah, totally.
Led to some of the most well-known TV shows of all time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Invincible is going to be up there with The Walking Dead once they rattle off a few seasons.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, I think because we've not had live-action Invincible yet, have we?
No, and I don't think we will. But
the cartoon's meant to be really good, isn't it?
Yeah,
you like it, don't you?
Yeah, it's great. Like, you would love it. Like, it takes the time, it builds everything, it does things slowly and surely. I spoil a bit for myself at one point because literally, and by spoil, I read the Invincible comic like way back when. I think just around when it finished, which apparently was 2017, because I've been listening to old episodes of the Weekly Planet, and 2017, they're like, oh, Invincible just wrapped up.
Yeah.
2017 wrapped up and I was reading around then and there was a character who I went, oh, I think this character dies this way. And then in the TV show, the character didn't die the way I thought they were going to die.
Yeah.
So then, and I went, oh, they've killed the character a different way. That's cool that I'm not one of those fans who's like, you have to do it exactly like the core, the source material. So I was like, oh, that's cool. They've done it a different way. And then the character turns out they didn't die. So I went,
It's
a fake out.
It's the old switcheroo.
That's interesting as well. And then I was like, wait, did this happen in the original comic? Because it was years ago, which I read it. Especially this part, because Invincible runs for like 200-300 issues or something ridiculous. So I went back and I was like, how did this character die? And I went, just to verify I wasn't like thinking the wrong thing. And I looked up the character, I went, this character dies this way. And I went, great, that's how I remember. And then he went, in this scenario. And I went, I'd completely forgotten that was the scenario they did their death in. And now I've just spoiled it for myself, even though I read it before, but I'd read it originally, since forgotten it, and then spoiled it to myself again before it happens in the TV show.
I did the exact same thing to myself reading The Lord of the Rings recently.
you'd forgotten a bit and then...
Yeah. Looked it up, went, oh, this isn't how it happened in the film. Looked it up and went, oh. I'm glad we spoke about it.
Yes.
Because I think if we didn't, it would kind of be a hole that we'd left. Like, new Kirkman stuff comes out, we kind of have to just talk about it. But I agree with you. It's middle of the road. I'm so hopeful for it, though. I'm really hopeful that what we're seeing is just that early kind of establish. As I said earlier, we're seeing the establishing shots now. We're seeing the first 35, 45 minutes of the film.
Yeah.
So I'm really hoping that it warms up, because there is clearly an appetite for stories that take place in the context of wider universes, right?
Yeah.
The MCU has clearly demonstrated that. The Disney with the Star Wars stuff has clearly demonstrated that. The continued success of Marvel and DC along those lines clearly demonstrated that.
Yeah.
And so I think there is room for third parties to make these sets of stories that exist within a wider universe. And so I'm really glad that this is happening.
Yeah.
I'm glad it's happening with some core interesting franchises behind it. I'm glad it's happening with Robert Kirkman on board.
Mm.
Like, I think this is teed up to be a real competitor to the MCU or the DCU. I think is geared up to be something really interesting. I just didn't necessarily like the first 8 issues of this title.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean a lot, does it? Because they're clearly teeing up to something grander here.
And you know what? Credit to Image and Skybound, the companies make. Skybound is Kirkman's company, but within Image. Credit to them. The old saying about franchises since the Marvel and MCU is every studio wants Avengers, but none of them want to make Iron Man.
Yeah, totally.
This right now, they are trying to make an Iron Man.
Yeah.
But not even more daring. They're making a new thing.
Yeah.
That's not even Iron Man. It's a new thing which is going to interact with Iron Man down the line. So credit to them for trying to properly build up this new franchise.
And this is what we saw with Rogue Son, and this is what we're seeing here is actually, finally, these third parties are looking at the success of the MCU and the DCU and saying, well, what if we tried to bootstrap something at this scale out of thin air, right? What if we tried to bootstrap something this big out of thin air? And it's commendable. You have to commend it.
Mm. Although, one thing I think I might be the reason for, the cynical take is now coming out. They've gone, oop, they're doing G.I. Joe Transformer films. Maybe Void Rival might get a film in a year or so. Like, I think they're already going, if this is popular this could fast track to film adaptation,
which, you know, cool.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean,
maybe.
As somebody who is quite invested in comic books at this point, I think it's dope when I see them get turned into stuff.
It's very interesting when you see, like, when you've read the source title and then you see it's been commissioned and it's going to be main stuff.
Yeah.
Especially with all the pitfalls we've had of earlier ones. You go, is it going to be good? Who knows? Like, it's a gamble. Who's attached to it? Oh, they're good. Hope they don't fuck it up. Like, it's interesting to go that roller coaster of emotions leading up to that. But yeah, I think that's all we can really say on the topic now, isn't it?
Yeah. So thank you so much for listening. This has been a rambly episode, but it's been a really fun one to make.
Going
to
be a lot of tangents listed in the episode description of this episode.
Fucking love a tangent.
I'm also going to put in the, here's where we start talking about the bloody comic. Because why not?
So thank you for listening. If you want to see some more of us, we make YouTube videos. They're on YouTube. comicliterate@gmail.com is our email address.
Yeah. And TikTok.
And yeah, like, we're in all the places. I do so many call to actions at the end of these. We're in places. There is a name on this podcast, The Comic Literate. Stick that into some places, you'll find us.
There's also a link tree in the episode description. So you can literally click and link to...
Fucking hit that link tree. Go find some stuff. We make things. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.
And next week, Star Wars something for Phantom
Menace. Ah, next week is Star Wars.
May the Vulcan be with you, you know?
May the Vulcan death grip be the fourth.
Yes, may the fourth Vulcan Spock. That's what they say. Thank you, goodbye.